All right, Erev Tov, everybody. Just before we start, after where people should be excited after missing last week, so we're eager to get back on the Würzburger Rub. But I want to thank our sponsors, Shira and Yisrael Hochberg from actually Teaneck, whose daughter Aura is getting married this Wednesday night to Yisrael Shmuder, and I just want to wish them Mazel Tov, and she should build a beautiful home. Parents, everybody should have lots of nachas, and we should have occasions to celebrate many happy occasions. So thank you very much, and Mazel Tov. And Dr. Mark, it's all yours.
Okay, and we know the grandparents, so he's done one side.
Of course we know the grandparents.
He came with us to Portugal.
Back, they got engaged.
And Yaakov's good friend also with the grandparents. Okay, everyone, it is November 20th, 2023, and let's get right to it. Class number 3 on Rav Zalman Ber Bamberger, the Würzburger Rav. You know, I listened to the class from 2 weeks ago. I mistakenly said Bamberger's was a supermarket. No, it was a department store. I still remember that. It's funny because 2 weeks ago, Tuesday, that was the first time really we heard about the rally, and I said that I don't know what's going to be. Is the right-wing world, the Haredi world, up until now, I said, they have refused to participate with the Jewish community as a whole. And I called attention to how in 2002, when they had the previous great rally in Washington, although there was a lot of pressure, they refused. And I said it would be nice if they participated, but don't know what's going to happen. And then the next day, or even maybe that night, I was sent... I guess that night someone sent me that the Aguda had sent out, in light of the ongoing life-threatening danger, et cetera, et cetera. They think it's important, midarche hashtadronus, that means to be involved, what you need to do, that there be a large turnout. Accordingly, in consultation with our rabbinic leadership, they say that we are circulating to our friends and constituents in information about the rally. It's funny, they don't say we urge everyone to go to the rally there. They simply, it's sort of a parve statement. They say it's important that there be a large turnout. Therefore, we're circulating information about it. They don't actually say we urge everyone to go. Okay, that's how it stood. So my attitude was, hey, this is interesting. They're sort of breaking with the previous approach. And from my perspective, I think it's a great thing. I said that if there was tens and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of black and white, it would be very nice. However, as we got closer to the rally, we saw that it wasn't so clear. And 2 days before the rally, someone on the Motzis Gedolei HaTorah comes out with a statement against going to the rally, stating that... that's not what Jews do. We don't go to rallies, which is factually completely incorrect. We have the World War II rally during the Holocaust. We had rallies in 67 and other times in which even places like Tells went. So I want to leave that aside because that doesn't really interest me. What does interest me is the statement that came out the night before, Rosh Chodesh Kislev, the night before the rally. In fact, many people late at night, many people only saw this when they were on the way to the rally. So then the question came up, do they turn around or not? And this relates very much to what we're going to do, because although the Aguda did come out in favor, a number of people in their Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah would come out against it. So there was obviously a divergence of opinion. And it could be also that the Aguda lay leadership was very much in support of it when the rabbinic leadership wasn't. But in the letter signed by a number of them, the Gedolim, it said in opposition to going to this, the opinion of our Rabbanim, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, whose Masor we hold, warned us from joining with religious streams who are far from the Derech HaTorah and Masorah. So that's exactly what we're speaking about now, and this is following the Hirshian view. It's not in line with the Nitziv's approach, which is the exact opposite of this. I find that a little bit unusual, because the Aguda really is supposed to represent the Litvisha world. And then it says, especially when this the schedule was published, The speakers are people whose essence is the opposite of Torah and Yira and Snius. Okay, I don't want to get involved in this. I think it's talk about a shtetl mentality. And in a bad sense, I fully agree with what Rabbi Beryl Wine said. If you haven't heard his audio about this, but the idea that, look, this is a propaganda war fought on all fronts. They're trying to do to Israel what did, rightly so, in that case, to South Africa. That means no sporting events, no entertainment, trying to turn the whole younger generation against it. Having an actress speak at the event is a good thing. It's a positive thing. We need all these people. This has to be fought on every single front. So, I mean, I can't understand that world. I can't understand the mentality. All I know is that when they come, as Rabbi Wein says, no one's protected. They're going to come. They're coming for you in Brooklyn. They're coming for you in Lakewood. They're coming everywhere. And if we can't stand together at such a circumstance, then I don't know what to say. We're never going to stand together. I want to return because I got a number of emails from people, including from Moshe from Lakewood and Moshe from Spring Valley, about actually first Moshe from Lakewood about the Nitziv. Remember the Nitziv? I quoted the Nitziv where he said about publishing the Wurzburger Rav's Tshuvot. He says that an individual, once they write the tshuvos, ein b'kocha v'reshuso la'abed osam l'gamri, sh'arei mitzvahu l'mod l'amein acherim, that if I write the tshuvos, I don't have the right to destroy them. If I want to destroy them completely, I can, okay, we spoke about that. So Moshe points out that this goes against many examples that we have of manuscripts that were not published. He said there's a famous story of the Chidush HaRim who had a manuscript on Choshen Mishpat, but the Kutzker told him to burn it. We have many, many examples of this. I have to say that the Nesiv's position, I do not consider it mainstream at all, because I think the mainstream position throughout history is, if I write a Sefer, I don't have to publish a Sefer. Why? Well, who says I have to publish a Sefer? It's my Sefer. I can do what I want with it. I haven't really heard anyone who disagrees with this other than Nitziv. The Briskers didn't publish their writings. I mean, that's my, if it's my Torah, I can decide whether it's worthy of being published or not. The Nitziv only said to the children that despite the fact that your father didn't want to write it, publish it, you have the right to publish it. That I would understand, because the father is modest. He doesn't want to take responsibility, but we don't need to accept that. We know that he was a good Obi Yisrael, and therefore we could publish it. But the idea that even the author himself doesn't have the right to publish it, that to me, I find a pretty extreme position. And let's say the author didn't feel it's 100% correct. So that's the first thing. The second thing, though, I want to note is that I mentioned, you know, the Nitziv compares to Truma. When we had a Beis HaMikdash, Truma couldn't be destroyed. It had to be given to a Kohen, but you can choose which Kohen you give it to. So I said it's also a tzedakah, that you can decide who you give it to, but you have to give it. So someone challenged me, but wait a second, you can destroy tzedakah. But, and I say, no, you can't destroy tzedakah. It's Baal Tashlis. If it's my money, you can't just go take a $100 bill or a $1 bill and just burn it for the sake of burning it. That's Baal Tashlis. Again, it is your money. But the fact is, as far as I understand, according to Halacha, you do not have the authority to burn it. When they used to start this crazy practice in Meron, I shouldn't say crazy, we shouldn't judge any practices, but the practice of burning clothes, you had Gedolim who said that that's Baal Tashlis. You can't just take clothes and burn it. So I said, well, it's not really Baal Tashlis because it has a purpose. But just to burn money, I guess if you're burning the money to make a point, maybe you're giving a Musar Drasha and you want to say you shouldn't be so materialistic, but you can't just destroy money. And I then thought of something which the Torah mentions, which I think supports my point that maybe there's a bit of a parallel between tzedakah and Torah for the Nitziv and Truma. If you look in Hilchos Tzedakah of the Torah, Resh Mem Zayin, he says as follows, that how should we regard money we give? I mean, he says that people, he begins by saying you shouldn't raise in your heart the idea that you can, lessen the amount of money you give to tzedakah. Why not? He says, Ki yesh lo ladas. Everyone should understand. She'ein hamamon shelo el pikadon. The money we have, we should regard it as a pikadon. And it's given to us to give tzedakah. But, that's why the money that's supposed to go to give tzedakah, we can't really say, I'm not going to give it to tzedakah. We're obligated to give it to tzedakah. We can choose who to give it to. But it's a pikadon. And that's what the Netziv says. You can, you have this Torah writing. You can decide where to publish it, what to do with it, all that, but you can't not use it. Having said that, I still think it's a bit of a stretch. Now, Moshe from Lakewood said that maybe in support of the Netziv, the Lech El Choshen Mishpat, Simon Yodalit, in the Din Torah, you can ask the Dayanim to explain to you in writing. They have to explain to you with proofs why they ruled against you. So he said that he suggests that maybe this shows that a Dayan has no ownership of his psak and he has to provide it. But I think that's a different case, because in that case, you're a nogea b'davar. They ruled against you. So you have the right to ruled for you even, I guess. You have the right to know why. It's not because the Dayan doesn't own his writings in the sense that it's just like Torah, he doesn't own it. This is a specific case. The Dayan is hired. That's his job. So we don't assume that he can just ex cathedra give his ruling. It's not Das Torah. He has to explain the basis of the ruling. That's different than just if I sit down and I write a sefer and then I go into the Netziv, I have to publish it. If Netziv was with us, I'd want to ask him, what do you mean you have to publish it, Netziv? Did you ever write a tshuva where you thought it was, you then changed your mind and thought it wasn't such good Torah and you didn't want to publish it? So I don't know how far to take that. Finally, this is from, again, Moshe from Lakewood and Moshe from Spring Valley. I raised the issue, if you recall, we're talking about Tzachelis a couple of classes ago, and I quoted the pre-Megodi in Simon Tess, Eshel Avraham, Vav, where he cites the Eliyahu Rabba, that Atalis Yarok, because we're talking about the stripe, remember? And I said that the early source mentions Atalis Yarok, that Zechar Letzchelis. And actually, right after that, it's Hanikra Blah, Bet Lamed Aleph. That means blau or blue. So I wondered, what's going on here? Is Yarok blue? I looked at Ben Yehuda's dictionary. There's no mention of that. But so I thank both of you for pointing out, for Moshe, for pointing out that Rashi is explicit through in Parshas Truma in the Mishnah Brachos. If you look there, Mishnah Brachos, 9, Tesam Abayz, 9b, he says explicitly that Tcheles is Yarok. And Moshe from Spring Valley called my attention to Tosfos in Sukkah, Lamed Aleph Amud Beis, where they give three approaches to Tcheles. One of them happens to be that it's the color of Esav, of grass. So Tcheles is green. Maybe you say turquoisey green, but and there's another approach that, what does Yarok mean? That Yarok is yellowish. Chel mon shel beitza. And finally, there's something that Yarok is, the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, from the time you can distinguish into Tcheles and Karsi. And so that implies, what is Karsi? Karsi, they say, is Yarok. The Gemara there says Yarok Karsi. So if it's a question of Tcheles to Karsi, that implies that Karsi, Yarok, is a form of dark blue. So, it's unclear what Yarok is. And it could very well be just another word for bluish, or it could mean green. It's unclear. And finally, and again, I thank this, I knew this, but I thank Moshe from Lakewood. we spoke about how, you could write tshuvas and say, don't rely on it. That was what the Reitz Elchanan spoke about. Well, this is a volume. It's of the grandson of the Chasam Sofer. This Oros Tshuva, the Shimon Sofer, the son of Rav Akiva, not Akiva, Rav Avram Shmuel, the Ksav Sofer, on every page of Asheros Tshuvos, volume one and the next, I think there's three volumes, he has at the top, Ein L'smoch Ahorazo. The whole Sefer is telling you don't rely on it. And as I already mentioned, there's a long tradition, you can see in the Sechem, and he discusses in detail, of saying you don't need to rely on this. And I can tell you that if you look in the halachic writings, they quote the Asheros Tshuva. And they do not pay attention to what he writes on that top line because they say he was being modest. And even though he says not to rely on it, we don't need to accept that because he might not have thought that it was worthy of being relied on, but we assume it's worthy of being relied on. Ad kan, let us pick up now. Oh, we got some stuff here today. I hope no one's going to be, maybe, I don't know if we'll get to it today. Maybe next, if anyone's going to be offended. All I can tell you is that, wait till you hear the language used in the dispute between, Rav Hirsch and, Rav Bamberger. But before we get to that, I want to continue with the story. The situation in Germany, as I mentioned, was that everyone needed to belong to a community. There were three communities. There was a Jewish community, a Catholic community, and a Protestant community. If you, at that time, you couldn't declare yourself an atheist, you had to be in one of the communities. Later on, you could be, have no, actually, I take that back. It could have been that already at that time, you could have been without a confession, like declare yourself as an atheist. I'm not sure. But if you were to be Jewish, you had to be in the Jewish community. Now, in 1873, the Prussian parliament, in those days, Frankfurt was controlled by Prussia. They changed the rules, the law, and they permitted Christians to establish independent religious communities. So you could establish a Baptist community, a Episcopalian. It doesn't just have to be Lutheran. When Hirsch saw this, he said, okay, now's our opening. If they're going to allow separate Protestant communities, then what was the basis for it? It was a question of conscience. It goes against Enlightenment values, modern ideas, that you're going to force me to belong to a church, a Lutheran church, when I'm not Lutheran. That is, yes, I find I can go to a any church I want to on Sunday, but you're forcing me to pay taxes out of part of my tax money, then goes to the Lutheran church. That's not right. Then the German parliament, led by liberals, now when I say liberals, a right-wing Republican today would be regarded as a liberal in 19th century Germany, but there were these liberal ideas, and they changed the rules. So once that happened, Hirsch thought that, hey, you know, now we can make our move. We can try to change the law so that Jews have the same situation, that if we want to create our own community, that we should be given the rights as well. And eventually he was successful in this. In 1876, he actually had the support of a Jewish member of parliament named Lasker. And the argument was freedom of conscience. And the lawmakers were convinced that it violated the freedom of conscience for the Orthodox to be forced to pay taxes to be in a community which didn't reflect their ideals. And I mentioned already last class that this is a bit ironic because when the Orthodox were the majority, they appealed to the government to shut down the Reformed temples and to take away their freedom of worship. But I also said that from the standpoint of Hirsch, that this was, you can't criticize him for this because he believed that that was always incorrect and that in modern times we can't force, just like the Orthodox can't force the non-Orthodox to be part of their community, the non-Orthodox can't force the Orthodox to be part of their community. And this is basic to the modern liberal approach. Ironic, because Israel has this problem. And anyone who believes in liberal ideas and freedom of conscience, I have to say, has to have a problem with the situation of Israel. And I'm saying this, it's not a problem really for the reformers. Well, I guess it is to be married in Israel. It is. Israel is the only country in the world that doesn't allow you to get married by the rabbi of your choice. And that's it's something the Mizrahi put in. And Hirsch would be very opposed to it, as I am opposed to it, because that shouldn't, we shouldn't be forcing people in the modern world to do anything against their conscience. Okay, so let me get back now to this 1876. We have this decision of parliament. Incredible victory for Hirsch. He saw this as nothing less than an opportunity from providence. Divine providence, not to be squandered. And immediately he announced that now that Jews who wish can withdraw from the general community, it is an obligation, no different than any other Torah obligation. That we all know that you know, we have to observe Shabbos and kashrus and everything. And he said it's the exact same thing, separating from the community, no different. Absolutely no different. For all the reasons that we'll see. Now, the problem that Hirsch had was that most of the Orthodox in Frankfurt had a nice Orthodox community. It was the minority, but it was a nice community. And he had, first of all, in the general community, but obviously his community, the separatist community, what they call the Austritzgemeinde, most of the Orthodox, including many of his followers, didn't buy the argument. Many of them had a feeling. So Hirsch gets up and he announces, you now are mechuyev, you're obligated to stop paying taxes to the general community. And I assume Hirsch probably thought, well, they're going to jump at this because now they've been paying double, until now they've been double taxation to the separatist community, voluntary, and to the general community. But many, I don't know if it's most, but many, including important people like the Rothschild family, said that we are not going to withdraw from the general community. We are going to continue to pay the taxes to the general community because that's, we're communal Jews. And although we also are members of the Hirschian community, we still believe in supporting the general community. There was a sense of, Achdus. There was a connection, you know, there's a cemetery also, although this wasn't the old cemetery where the Gedol Yisroel are buried in, because they started, if you go to Frankfurt, you can see that, where the Pnei Yeshua, Nosson Adler, and others, there was a new cemetery which had been around not that long, I think 30, 40 years, but there still was a sense that the new cemetery was a continuation of the traditional cemetery, and if their parents are buried there, their grandparents are buried there, they wanted to be part of this. Hirsch thought this was insane. He writes about, you make your choice because of a cemetery? We'll have our own cemetery. But many of the people in Hirsch's community refused to separate. They obviously continued to remain in his community, and they paid double taxation. So how to get the people to agree? Well, Hirsch had followers, important followers, and they came up with the idea that they can get the Würzburger Rav. You know, it's bad enough, they said, that the Rav of the community, or Shamsher Rav or Hirsch, says that you have to separate and people don't listen. But and they assume that that's because they thought this is a dispute. The other rabbis disagree with Hirsch. So they want to put an end to this once and for all. And the idea was, if you get the Gadol Hador of Germany, the Würzburger Rav, Rav Zalman Baer Bamberger, if he also declares in agreement with Hirsch that you can no longer remain part of the general community by, in an official sense, that means by paying taxation, that no one who claims to be an Orthodox Jew will have a leg to stand on, and they'll have to acknowledge, they'll have to go along. Look, we're Orthodox Jews. We know that one rabbi says something. If there's another rabbi who says something else, people have what to rely on, and you really can't read them out of the community, anything like that. But if all the Gedol Yisrael, all the poskim, conclude with one voice, then if you're a Torah Jew, you have to go along with what they said. And they invite Bamberger. First, he didn't want to come, but they came to him and they asked him, and he agreed he's going to come to Frankfurt because he says he wants to see the situation up close and speak to the people there before he gives his decision. But the followers of Hirsch had no doubt that he was going to rule for them. That was why they invited him. And in previous circumstances, he had come out with rulings saying that if you have a chance to separate, there were places which allowed the communities to separate. And he said, you have to separate. In Vienna, I mentioned, in Wiesbaden. So they thought this was an open and shut case. And the problem was that Bamberger comes, and we're going to see in more detail in a few minutes who he spoke to, but he comes to Frankfurt. He obviously speaks to the people on the separatist side, and then he speaks to the people in the general community, the Gemeinde, one of whom was a pious and learned Jew named Rav Moshe Mainz, a businessman, but if you read Bamberger's writings, you see that he regarded him as a huge Talmud Chacham, a tzaddik, and Bamberger meets with them, this group led by Mainz, and he learns something which he didn't know, that the community, the general community, had agreed to do everything the Orthodox community wanted. After all, the general community was worried about the people leaving the community because that they lose a lot of tax money. So they'll build a new shul. They're going to open up the mikveh. Anything the traditionalist community wants, they will do. Obviously, there's the old age home will be kosher, the hospital, all these things. And remember, by remaining part of the larger community, that means that there will be a beis din. At this time, the reformers, although they did marriages, they didn't do gittin. And some of them didn't believe in get, but for most Jews, even you wanted a get. And there was a fear, obviously, that they could open up their own beis din. As long as the traditionalists were in the community, the beis din would be for the community, would be run by the Orthodox. These are all considerations. So after hearing all this, Rav Zalman Ber Bamberger declares that under the circumstances, when the larger community agrees to all of the demands of the Orthodox, and they're not going to interfere in any way in the internal runnings of the community, I no longer see any obligation to separate. He's not saying you can't separate. He's not saying it's a bad thing to separate. He's simply saying that it's a reshus. It's an option. You are no longer obligated to separate. Therefore, all these Orthodox Jews who are in the general community, they can continue going to the synagogue and paying their taxes to the general community because their tax money is going to the hospital, back to their community. They're not supporting. They're in a minority. They're not supporting the reformers. Now, this was a great shock because Hirsch was convinced that no reputable Orthodox rabbi would ever be able to oppose him. And here, not just any rabbi, but the leading halakhic authority in Germany. So, and they were the ones that created this mess because they invited Bamberger to come. Had they not asked him to come, he might never have weighed in on this matter. And Bamberger is from the old school traditionalists. So I actually think that there's some subconscious, perhaps, influence going on here. Remember, Hirsch is he instituted reforms. Reforms with a small R. He abolished Kol Nidre for a time, we saw. He had a choir in the synagogue. He did weddings in the synagogue, all sorts of things like this. I think it's important for him to show that his form of Judaism has no connection whatsoever to reform, real reform with a capital R. Bamberger is an old-fashioned Rav. It's the idea that you're going to sit with a non-Orthodox rabbi and discuss, how to improve the hospital, the Jewish hospital. That, to him, wouldn't really be a big deal. It wouldn't bother him so much. They're not talking Torah. They're talking general matters. And he doesn't need, no one's going to, he's not what they call neo-Orthodox. No one's going to talk about Bamberger like he has anything in common with the reformers. So I think maybe there's a something subconscious here. He doesn't need to separate himself so far. By the way, Bamberger's position was really the position that was to be found in Poland and Lithuania as well. It's only in Germany and also in Austria-Hungary, that you had this separatism. Let us not forget that in every single community in Poland and Lithuania, you had one kehila. And on the kehila board, you'd have the Bundist, you'd have the Zionist, and you'd have the Orthodox. And they would all argue about, about who's going to be the rabbi and who's... And some people might say, well, that's different because they're not reformers. They're just irreligious. I don't. As far as Hirsch is concerned, there's no difference. And what's the? And it's the same issues. They fought over religious matters. They sat and they defended this position, and they explained why we disagree with the separatist Orthodox. This explains why all these East European Jews who came to Frankfurt and other German cities, they didn't join the separatist community. They joined the regular community. And you tell them, well, in the regular community, there's also reformers. How does that affect them? The shul they go to is an Orthodox shul. Their whole life is Orthodox. The fact that there's other people in the community who are not Orthodox, it doesn't affect them. That was how they lived in Poland and in Lithuania, where they were non-Orthodox and Orthodox in the same community. That's just the way it was. There's a book by Robert Liberalis. It's called Religious Conflict and Social Context, The Resurgence of Orthodox Judaism in Frankfurt on Main, 1838 to 1877. And he says the same thing on page 225. He says that this controversy in Hirsch and Bamberger was between old Orthodoxy and new. He says that Bamberger is defending the old order against upheaval of religious values, tradition and community against modernity and separation. Perhaps, I don't know if I go that far, but that's the point he makes. I also want to read you something, mention something that Adam Furziger points out in his book, Exclusion Hierarchy, page 136. It's a very good chapter on the Auschwitz controversy. And on page 136, he deals with a letter, responds him, that Bamberger has regarding a Shabbos violator in his town. And he says that he went to him, he spoke to him, he wrote him a letter trying to, you know, convince him to become Shomer Shabbos. I guess probably in his early years he was. He says, I didn't speak harshly. I didn't embarrass him in public. I only hope that through this, his soft approach, I will achieve the required goal. So we see Bamberger understood that they were non-Orthodox Jews, and he believed in a more soft approach, perhaps you could say, put it that way. He was certain, he was insistent, that non-Shomer Shabbos Jews cannot be members of the board of a shul. That Bamberger said they can't. But when it came to the individual Shabbos violators, you see that he recognized that sometimes honey is better than vinegar. And we'll see that this is relevant to his open letter. According to the Wurzburger Rav, if you're in one kehila that's responsible for different communal organizations, including religious organizations, this does not mean you're recognizing the religious legitimacy of the non-Orthodox. The fact that you pay taxes to one community and tax money goes here and goes there, you're not recognizing them. You're both Jews. They're sinning Jews. You're not sinning Jews. So he didn't think this was how does being in one kehila recognize the reform? He said it doesn't recognize the reform. They're the majority, so we have to pay taxes to them. So we'll pay taxes to them because there's other things that are done that are for our benefit. But we don't need to separate. He's not saying there's anything wrong separating, and it appears that he thought it even was better to separate. I would even go that far. But there's no obligation. And as we've said, he was not an ideological opponent to separatism. Okay. before I get to this, the back and forth between them, I want to read you what he said. Well, he writes to Hirsch, when Hirsch pretty much accuses him of betrayal, he says to him, I too regarded the secession law on July 28th, 1876 as a great blessing for Orthodox Judaism. It is a blessing. The only reason the general community agreed to compromise and give the Orthodox everything they wanted was because of the threat of separatism. As we already said on a number of occasions in Karlsruhe, also in 1869, when the general community put an organ in the main synagogue, Bamberger encouraged separatism, and he also, as I said, signed an open letter supporting the Vienna separatism. Let me give you another example. In Wiesbaden, we have a letter. This is mentioned in Hamburger's biography at the end of Kol Kisvei the Wurzburger Rav, pages 542 and 43. He says that if you're in a community and they don't provide the following, that is a shul, a mikvah, a school, shlita, all these basic things, if you're not inside, if they don't do that, then you should separate. And he says that even if you have to be buried, that's even if you're not going to be buried in a Jewish cemetery, even if you're going to be buried in a non-Jewish cemetery, he says if you're in a community which doesn't provide the basic essentials for traditional Jewish life, you separate from that. And if that means you lose your place in the cemetery, and it could be you're in a small town where there's only one Jewish cemetery, and there, since you're not paying taxes, you can't be buried there. He says, if that means you're buried in a non-Jewish cemetery, so be it. So you see how far Bamberger would go. But in the case of Frankfurt, when there was no reason to go, and we'll see that there's still value in keeping the communal ties. We'll see that soon. He says you don't have to. Okay, I want to read you now some things that. Well, first, let me say that this statement of Bomberger, his rejection of Hirsch's ruling, caused an enormous dispute to break out, a dispute that would continue even after their deaths. Hirsch and Bomberger really went at it. You can see that they might have been friends before this, but after this, they're no longer friends. To say that they found each other annoying is putting it mildly. There was a complete break, and I'm a little surprised and impressed that the Hirschian Society in Washington Heights actually published the letters, because the things that were said, I can see people saying, well, we shouldn't remember what was said, but it's very harsh. And look, it's part of history. We should know what Gedol Yisrael, the Ish for Gedol Yisrael, how in the midst of a dispute, because when we see the Gedolim of our day sometimes act like this, we can say it has a long history, a long tradition. And I want to read you some of what they said. And the first thing I want to point to is that Hirsch makes a good point. I mean, after recovering from the shock of Bomberger ruling against him, Hirsch states that, Rabbi Bomberger, what you did is completely inappropriate, out of line. You went against a basic halacha. We know that there's a halacha when a local rav rules on something. An outside rav cannot come in and express a contrary position. And we all can appreciate that and understand that, because otherwise you'd have chaos. Can you imagine if the local rav said something and another rabbanim would come in and say, you don't have to listen to the rabbi? We understand that. On the other hand, we can also understand that if your local rav says something and then like Rav Avadi Yosef comes to town, or Official Schechter, I saw this personally with Official Schechter, and he comes to town and he says something else, we can understand that here you have the local rabbi said one thing and Rosh Shachter said you don't have to do this. We can understand why people would say, well, you know, well, I'm going to follow Rosh Shachter. He's the God of the door. So we can understand, we can appreciate that. So not to mention the fact that in this case, Bomberger was invited in. But I want to read you something. And this comes, you can see this on page 233. After Hirsch had said that, Rabbi Bomberger, you're completely out of line because you came into my town and you're giving a psak against what I say, and we know you can't do that. It's a chacham sha'asar, a chacham who's forbid something, another chacham can't permit it. I want to read you what Rabbi Bomberger says. I don't need to elaborate on it. You can hear it for yourself, and then I'll read you what Hirsch replies. But this is what Bomberger says. Quote, the principle of Chacham Sha'asar V'chule can be invoked only if the rabbinic qualifications of both the authorities consulted are equal. If, on the other hand, the second authority is recognized as having outstanding qualifications, that authority is under no obligation to defer to a ruling which, according to his conviction, is in error. And he says, a rabbi of generally recognized superior qualifications is not bound to accept the ruling of a rabbi with other qualifications if he is convinced that the ruling of the latter is in error. So he doesn't explain any further. Hirsch said that I gave a psak, you have no right to issue another psak because of the principle of Chacham Sha'asar. And Rabbi Bomberger replies, that principle only applies if both rabbis are equal. But if one rabbi is greater than the other, he's not obligated. And that would apply to my example. If the local rabbi says something, or Herschel Schechter comes in and says, no, that's not the halacha, you wouldn't have to follow the local rabbi. Bomberger is saying that, yes, Rabbi Hirsch, you're a nice rabbi and all, but we're not in the same league. And I don't have to, I'm not bound by you because, look, at the end of the day, Gedolim know who they are. And he's saying, I'm not bound by you. We're not equal here. I'm a rabbi of greater standing than you. This was very hurtful. I mean, he's mocking Hirsch's rabbinic learning. This was very hurtful to Hirsch. And I'll just read you what he says in response to it, because um, I mean, it's not just that. Bamberger basically is the Gadol Bisrael, the Gadol Ador, and he's treating Hirsch as like a local rabbi. He begins his letter, because what happened was after Bamberger made his statement, Hirsch publishes an open letter attacking Bamberger's position. Bamberger begins his reply as follows. He says, I don't want to enter into the detailed particulars in your letter, you know, going into detailed refutation. Why not? I am afraid, dear Rabbi, it would not do you credit. I am now faced with the full impact of the prohibition against humiliating someone in public, against Malbim Pnei Chaver Barabim, in all its momentous and shocking significance. He says that he has no choice. On the one hand, he doesn't want to reply, because if he replies, he'll have to embarrass Hirsch in public by showing that he doesn't understand the Gemaras and the Halacha. On the other hand, he says he has to say something, because his position has been attacked. So he says that he's going to limit himself to the most essential facts and cite them, he says, in a tactful manner. He says, I'm not going to get into the details here because I don't want to embarrass you. Okay, it's not a very common thing for a rabbi to say this. So we see already that Bamberger was himself insulted by the open letter of Hirsch. And Bamberger has a son, Rav Simcha Bamberger. He wrote the Tshuva Zecher Simcha. If you look in, it's Simon 230, Reish Lamed, the son says, I'll read more of it later, his son says that, what do you expect from my father? Did Hirsch come to him privately and discuss this matter? No, he publishes an open letter. So Bamberger responds as strongly and as harshly, and a real takedown of Hirsch in a way that it really isn't fair, because granted, Hirsch is not at the level of Bamberger. No one's going to say that in terms of halachic knowledge. But this is not only about halacha, it's about hashkafa. Now, it's true that there's a lot of halacha, and Hirsch argues, he holds his own, he argues against Bamberger. Some people think Hirsch got the better of this argument, other things Bamberger got the better. But it's not just a halacha argument, there's a lot of hashkafic elements as well. And look, I happen to be a great admirer of Rav Bamberger, but I can't see how that's appropriate to we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be the ones who we take insults and we don't insult. I don't see how, as the Gadol Hador, he needs to state that I don't want to get into the details because I don't want to embarrass you. That seems to me a low blow. It's not a low blow for him to say the other thing, that the Chacham Sha'asar, don't tell me, Rabbi Hirsch, that I can't give a ruling, because that only applies if people are the same level. You can easily see a dayan on a beis din, if a little yeshiva bacher were to say something against the dayan, could say, you know, we're not at the same level here. That, I think, it's okay to say, but I don't see how he could embarrass Hirsch that way and say that basically you're in the minor leagues here and I'm in the major leagues. And we see that this was hurtful to Hirsch. I want to read you what he says, because after this long reply from Bamberger, there's then a long response, very long response from Hirsch. And he says as follows. He says that the way you respond to me at the beginning, the earlier Rabbi Bamberger never would have done so. He says that you, Rabbi Bamberger, say that you have a lot to say, but you're not going to do it so as not to violate the prohibition of Malbim B'nei Chavero, humiliating another person in public. But you fail to see that precisely by stating that you seek to guard against this sin, it's already being committed to the greatest extent possible. In other words, Rabbi Bamberger says, I don't want to get into the details of halachic argumentation with you, Rabbi Hirsch, because I don't want to embarrass you because of your lack of knowledge. But by saying that, you're actually saying to the whole world that he has no knowledge. So that's... you're accomplishing the same thing. We have other examples where people, where they say, I don't need to get into this. But by saying that itself, you're showing you're humiliating here. So Hirsch is saying you're humiliating me by saying you're not going to discuss halakhic matters because you don't want to embarrass me. By that very word, you're embarrassing me because you're telling the world that I'm not worthy of it being discussed. What else is Hirsch saying? Who says he says it again. He says, "You conclude that you, because you're recognized gadol, mimeni, a scholar known to be greater than me, that you're within your right to be mater that which I, a lesser chacham, have declared as usur." And then he says, "As regarding your gadlus, your greatness, you publicly claim your greatness with such praiseworthy modesty as being generally recognized. You express a proud self-assurance, etc., etc. You," he says, "you self-elevated yourself to the status of a gadol." And here says, you know, if anyone want to show me how little Torah knowledge I have, I would give him a handshake and say, you know, you're right. I'm not a great Torah scholar. But here says, "But if anyone should proclaim with proud self-assurance to me and to anyone else who will listen, I am the gadol, I am the great scholar, I am far greater from you," here says, "that I'm not going to listen." You know, it's one thing for someone to say, "You're not such a great Torah scholar, Rabbi Hirsch," because none of us are great Torah scholars. That I'll accept. I'm not a great Torah scholar. But if for someone to say to me, "I'm the gadol and you're a nobody," that I'm not going to accept. He says, "The days are long past when it was a distinguishing trait of a Talmud Chacham to be makir es makomo, to be able to decide for himself which class he was in. Years ago, Rabbanim," he says, "could determine, am I this great? Am I that great?" And here says that today, with when everyone's trying to outdo one another in extravagant titles, and everyone's a goan, a mufa, he says that this is not the proper approach. And okay, I don't need to go into any more details with this, but we see here how hurt Hirsch was. And Hirsch even says that, you know, you can be a harif. Yes, okay, Rabbi Bamberger, you're a harif. You're a great Talmudic genius, but here says there's also something called harifus shel hevel. You can also have phony Talmudic learning, and you could be brilliant, he says, in harifus, but not know how to decide halacha, and you may not have the deah necessary, the knowledge necessary for a Talmud Chacham. So, and then he says, "Who among who today would presume to rate his own qualifications?" Okay, so Bamberger starts with a shocking putting down, belittling of Hirsch's Talmudic learning and halachic knowledge, and Hirsch replies that the very fact that you behave this way and you try to show that you're greater than me and declare yourself the gadol shows that you're not worthy of deciding such matters, because basically saying you let gaiva get in the way. Yeah, that's what I mean when I say that they. It was not an easy dispute. And then it gets, and I'm not going to get into all the details of the halacha, because it's a typical halacha dispute, back and forth. You can decide yourself what which side you think is better. And of course, there's a hashkafa angle floating over the entire thing, which we will get into. How do you judge the community? We're going to see with Bamberger. How do you judge modern Reform Jews? Are they all lahachis who want to destroy Torah Judaism? Or are they people who don't know any better? And as we'll see for Bamberger, if most of them don't know any better, then we should not regard them like just as heretics, the way Hirsch wants to regard them. I'm talking about even the leadership he's talking about. What I want to do is I want to call attention just to some important passages in both Bamberger and maybe a couple of responses in Hirsch, but mostly in Bamberger. I fundamentally, yes, it's a halachic dispute, but as I said, it's also a hashkafic dispute, how to relate to the Reform community. So let me mention a few things which I think you'll find of interest. It's a long letter from Bamberger. It's from 226 to 253, almost 30 pages. And then Hirsch has a much longer response, and Bamberger doesn't reply. And Bamberger's son explains that he doesn't reply. He says that, what does he say here? He says not only did his father not reply, he prevented his followers from also replying to Rav Hirsch, because he didn't want the he wanted to be men no loving to inamovin. He wanted to be the one who is offended and doesn't give offense, and he wanted the dispute to die down. Okay, so what is what are the some of the important things that I want to call your attention to in Rav Bamberger's open letter, and this dispute between the two of them, which remains until the war, I guess until today. We'll see what Rav Chaim Moshe Grodzinski has to say when he's called to decide this dispute. This is the two sides Till the end of German Jewry, you had two types of communities. You had the separatist community and you had the general community. And each side, one side points to Hirsch and the other side points to Bamberger. And at the end of the day, if you have Rav Bamberger stating you don't need to separate, then you can't really prove to anyone. The Hirschians would continue to try to prove how you have to, how Bamberger is wrong, how you have to separate, how you have to join our community, all that. At the end of the day, I'm a Baal HaBos, I'm a religious Jew. I don't need to get the halachic back and forth. All I know is that the God of Ador, Bamberger says I don't need to leave the community. And that's enough. And that became enough for almost pretty much all, most, the overwhelming majority of Orthodox Jews in Germany. Because in most communities, you didn't have separatists. There's maybe, what, seven, I think, eight separatist communities. And even in these places, most Orthodox Jews do not belong to the separatist communities. And you can't tell them that they had to, because Rav Bamberger said differently. And after Rav Bamberger, the Matei Levi and other Gedolim as well agreed with Bamberger. Okay, so what are some of the points, though? Because on the one hand, Hirsch makes important arguments. That how can you be in a community that is led by the reformers? Even if they agree to give the Orthodox everything they want, you're still part of a community run by reformers. You're giving them legitimacy, recognition. What does Bamberger reply to this? Well, on page 220, in the collected writings, beginning of page 228, he says, as I mentioned already, that the law of separatism is a good law, because there will be times when it's important and necessary. However, he says that this isn't always the case, and he begins attacking Hirsch by saying, you, Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, said that any religious Jew will understand that you have to secede from this community, and if you don't secede, you're holding up our geula. He says anyone who's sincere in his adherence to religious truth will understand this. And Hirsch goes further. He says that only a person to whom religious truth has become altogether meaningless would feel it's okay to remain in such a community. So what does Bamberger say? Rabbi Hirsch, how can you say such a thing? Don't you know that there are great Talmidei Chachamim, Lamdanim, including Rav Moshe Mainz in Frankfurt, you can see his grave when you go to the Frankfurt Cemetery, who disagree with you? Bamberger says, if you would express your opinion, this is my opinion, offer a lot of argument, fine, we can have a debate. But for you to get up and say that anyone who does not separate from this community, the general community, now that the government allows you to, that such a person, religious truth has been meaningless. He only pays attention to religious matters out of extraneous considerations. How can you say that, Bamberger says, about Yireim Ushleimim, people he calls Chachmei Velomdei Torah Veoskim Mitzvos, with the Rav Moshe Mainz at their head? He says that... Okay, and he goes on and on saying that this is completely nonsensical and disrespectful, and how can you have a serious argument when you're totally discounting all these religious Jews? Okay, and that's the first thing he begins with. So already you see that Bamberger is upset with Hirsch because he thinks that Hirsch has degraded and belittled Talmidei Chachamim and pious Jews in a matter that they could be a respectful disagreement. And he says that Hirsch is not disagreeing respectfully. Then he adds, on page 236, he gets to the question of, Hirsch says, it's obvious that we have to separate because this community, namely the general community, is led by people who have stricken from its prayer book every reference to the person of Mashiach, to Kibbutz Galiot, to the gathering of the exiles, to the restoration of the base of Migdash, to the Seder Avoda, the sacrificial things, to the his eliminated the land of Israel, the covenant, Malchus Beis David. What name do you give to such a system when the leaders of it preach that the mitzvahs of Torah and Chukasah are outdated? Okay, so what does Bamberger say? Such a community is clearly, this is a community of minus and apikorsis. And any time you have a community that's advocates that, we understand that this is something we need to completely oppose. However, Bamberger says something else, and this is what we're going to get into next time. He says, does this mean, therefore, that every individual and even groups of individual who state these matters, which are definitely minos and apikorsos, namely, let's say, denial of Mashiach, denial of Malchus Beis David, does this mean that all the people who advocate these ideas are themselves to be regarded as minim? Hirsch assumes that if you have a community whose leaders have, that makes the community as a whole a community of heretics and we can have no connection to them. What Bamberger is going to say is that, yes, their ideas are heresy, but does that mean that every single one of these people in the community are themselves to be regarded as no different than heretics of old? When these people don't know any better, and we're going to get into the great dispute, the famous dispute of the Rambam and Raivat about Kfirah B'Shogeg. And the Bamberger's position, just to anticipate, is going to be that you cannot judge a non-Orthodox Jew and regard them as an evil heretic just based on what they believe, because we have to know why they believe it. For all we know, these are people who were brought up with these ideas, and they don't know any better, and they're not trying to destroy Judaism. And especially when you see that they're willing to bend over backwards to help the Orthodox, can we regard their community as a community of heretics? In other words, we'll have to distinguish between heresy and heretics. So that's going to be a very important point, a point which I think many people will find valuable, because it continues in our day, and it's an old dispute, and we will pick up with that next class, next week, God willing. But let me get to the questions and comments. This very, very important dispute. Someone privately texts me there. Aaron Feldman released an interesting 2-page letter today about his position on the rally. Yes, I read it, and listen, I have respect for all Gadol Yisrael, but that letter, I find it doesn't say anything to me. He's upset that he can't send his people there because they sing Hatikva and the president of Israel speaks. It's a rally for Israel, for heaven's sakes. So if you don't like Hatikva because you think it's too secular, you can stand there and be quiet while everyone else does. You have to judge what's the Ikar and what's Tafel. And that the president of the state of Israel should not address the Aguda deputies in Israel stand for the Hatikva. That we're supposed to have a rally and the president of the state of Israel is not welcome? He's the representative of the state of Israel, the ambassador. Well, how can you even have such a concept that you're going to say that that makes it a puzzle rally? That all doesn't make any sense to me. And then of the other issue, Pastor Hagee, to have a Christian preacher speak. Pastor Hagee has thousands and thousands of followers. This battle can only be won with the support of the Christian community, the evangelical community. Pastor Hagee is not a missionary. He doesn't try to. Yes, he believes at the end of days, the Jews will recognize Jesus. Hey, and you know what? I got news for people. We believe at the end of days that Pastor Hagee will recognize that Jesus is not the Messiah. We say it in Aleinu. So as long as we can push that argument off for the eschatological future, and we don't, it's not a contemporary issue, then what's the problem? This is a man who is able to bring assistance to the state of Israel, to the people of Israel. And if the people running this event thought that this would be valuable, that non-Jews across the country can see this, especially we know with younger evangelicals are turning against Israel, how can this be wrong? Are we afraid that someone from the Neri Yisrael Yeshiva is going to be influenced by the missionaries? I don't understand it. I don't, who's the governor from, what's her name? Her father, she was this press secretary for Trump. Now she's the governor. And he was also a senator, but he was a preacher.
Huckabee.
I mean, you can have
Huckabee.
Huckabee, yeah. So I don't understand it. It's just not, as Rabbi Bellerwein said, it's just not my world. I don't see how listening to a non-Jewish clergymen talk about how important it is for America to support the state of Israel. I don't see how that's, I just don't get it. And for those who said, well, there should have been rabbis there, the OU said no rabbis. They don't want rabbis, because if you're going to have Orthodox rabbis, then you have to have Reform rabbis. They wanted to keep it just parv. If you notice, no women singers. It was only religious, it was only men and mostly religious. Yishai Rebo, the Maccabees singing. And look, it was a political rally. It wasn't a Tehillim rally. That's just the way it was. So maybe they could have put a Tehillim in one of them. But they, well, let's start looking at the glass half full, not half empty. This is a whatever. That's and yes, I saw that there was a grenade found in Lakewood. Yeah, and someone says that for privately that the Agudas Rabbonim did boycott a 67 rally for Israel because Ramosha said it was inappropriate to participate in an event at which conservative reform rabbis had prominent roles. That gets to the issue we saw with the Rav. But they were very careful this event. No rabbinic, no rabbis. Only and I have to tell you, there were many, many people from the yeshiva world, from Passaic, from all sorts of Muncie. You didn't have Hasidim, unfortunately. You had Chabad, many Chabadniks there, and you had from the yeshiva world. They came. They definitely came. Some went. But I'd like to think maybe when they're putting us Chas V'Shalom into the gas chambers, maybe then we can all agree to stand up together. I don't know. Morris says that burning coals is worse than Baal Tashas, it's Avodah Zarah. If you follow the history of the bonfire tradition, there's several scholarly articles that trace the pagan origins. Yes. But I'll say to you, Morris, that the poskim who dealt with this don't know or don't recognize or accept that there's any Avodah Zarah element here. That's something that academics like yourself can point to, but the poskim who deal with this, as far as I know, they only deal with the Baal Tashlis aspect, that it's a waste, just burning clothes. Yeah, listen, if you read Daniel Sperber's book, you'll see the argument there that the whole idea of Upsharon, where they go to Meron and do that
Exactly.
also has a pagan origin. So,
Exactly.
well,
And it's all connected.
yeah.
And by the way, the burning of the clothes doesn't start till the end of the 18th century. There are several articles, by the way, on this exactly on this topic. One by
Yes, but
me and
that's
one
not
by
the post scheme.
Boaz.
But the post scheme
But I
don't know about the Avodah Zarah. So they just focus on the Baal Tashlis aspect.
well,
If you
maybe they
showed
need
it to
to.
them, maybe they would. If you showed
Maybe
a
they need
Rosh
to be
Hashanah this,
educated.
okay. But a post-Sikh in Eastern Europe in the 19th century, how is he supposed to know about the history? The academic articles don't come out to the end of the 20th century, so he doesn't know about it.
That's true, but the best example is the proof that Upsharon, that there's an old saying, if you want to know if something is Jewish, how do you call it in Hebrew? And Upsharon Dafka, so you'll say, what do the Sephardi Jews call it? Halakha, which is Arabic. There is no Jewish Hebrew term for Upsharon, which proves it's not a Jewish custom.
Okay, but you can also say that a practice, even if it had an origin, maybe in some sort of old ritual, especially in Hasidus, they speak about, as you know well, the idea that you can be metai or something, you can raise up the sparks, and you can turn it into a Jewish practice.
Yeah,
In other words, it's not like anyone today is doing something because it was recreated and,
yes, it's a modern creation. All right.
Zoom, thank you though for their comments. Zoom user says that blue, green, and yellow merge in the light spectrum, so it's easy to confuse them. I don't know, it's easy to confuse yellow and blue. I don't know. That doesn't seem so easy to me. Green and blue, yes. If you recall last week, I quoted 2 weeks ago Rabbi Tzvi Ron in his article translates it as Yarok as because he recognizes Yarok as Techelos was he translates it as turquoise. David says that there's a story about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik that he heard from his nephew, Rav Meir Lichtenstein of Beit Shemesh, about destroying money. He was once traveling on a plane with a backpack full of books as a carry-on, and the airline representative claimed that he had to pay a $50 overweight fine because of the weight. He argued with the representative that no fine was owed since the international flight regulations do not speak about the weight of the carry-on, rather its physical dimensions. And after the representative refused to give in, Professor Soloveitchik proceeded to remove a $50 bill from his wallet and ripped out the bill in front of the representative. Rav Meir told, by the way, I think you'd have to get another 50 because the airline wants the money. Rav Meir told over the story in the context of Suga Tukva Kohen and Bab Metzia, where the person fighting with ownership with a certain item proceeded to make it into Hekdesh. Now, so is it Baal Tashlis? I guess Professor Soloveitchik would say it's not Baal Tashlis because he's making an important point that can only be made with the $50 bill. If you can buy a steak for $50 and eat it, you can make a point, I guess. And apparently, Professor Soloveitchik presented a copy of the flight regulations to prove his point. Someone privately texts me that he too has a problem with the situation in Israel, that only Orthodox rabbis and only certain Orthodox rabbis, selected Orthodox rabbis, can do weddings, funerals, and the like, and it's a violation of human rights. He says, we don't want to air our linen in public. Okay, it's, I don't know if this is considered public. Hadassah says, after 1874 in Prussia, vital records were normally kept by religion. The civil registration was a mix of all religions. But until 1876, Jews had to belong to the Jewish community, not Christians. They can belong different, but Jews had to belong to the Jewish community. And that's that was the reason for the law, the change of the law, that created officially the Auschwitzgemeinde. And Ellie says that the so-called Einheitsgemeinde, the one community, is still the going model in much of Europe. The community is headed by an Orthodox rabbi and run by Orthodox principles, and many members are not very observant. Many marry out. Yes, that's interesting, but you go to a place like Berlin, the community is not headed by an Orthodox rabbi. You have Orthodox and non-Orthodox, and I guess they'd be equal. So you have the Chabad rabbi, Rav Techtal, he's a member of the community, and you have Rabbi Sievers and others. So they're like, they each run their own show, no one interferes, but they're each part of the community. In other places, it is a completely non-observant community. You go to most of the places you go to. You go to places like places we go to, Portugal, for instance, Spain. In the cities, they appoint an Orthodox rabbi because the community is officially Orthodox, even though the people are not Orthodox. But remember, those are communities that don't have Reform segments. In other places where you have Reform segments, then you have the issue. Berlin also has today, it has an Auschwitzgemeinde, the community of Rabbi Josh Spinner, the Adas Yisrael. That's the community that a few weeks ago the Molotov cocktails were thrown at. On our trips to Berlin, we ate there. So you still have, I think in Basel even today, in Switzerland, you have a separatist Orthodox community. So you still could have it. And it's the same thing as you mentioned in Cape Town. And look, England, that was always the model. In England, the model was that the communities could be non-observant, but they'll be officially Orthodox. So you could have a rabbi with no Shomer Shabbos in the whole community, but at least the community is observant. And that's what it is in Israel. Israel, you have every city will have a rav of a town. Sometimes they have two, Ashkenazi, Sephardi. The fact you could be in a town where the majority are not religious, but the community, it's still religious. And that's the, in Israel, what do you have? You have a very small group called the Eda Haredit. And there were people, originally the German Orthodox, the separatist Orthodox, they looked to the Eda Haredit. And all the German Orthodox in the Frankfurt community, their rabbi was Rav Dushinsky and Rav Sonnenfeld. That was not the Aguda position. It was not the Aguda position in Lithuania and Poland. And even the German Orthodox understood that in the state of Israel, this isn't going to work. So you still, to this day, you have a small community. It's called the Eda Haredit. They're following the old separatist approach of Hirsch. Rabbi Kelman says, you imagine this is what Rav Shimon Schwab referred to when he explained why yeshivas don't study Jewish history. Unlike others, he asserted when teaching history, you must teach the truth. He preferred certain truths be hidden. Yes, he specifically mentions disputes, that we don't need to know about the details of disputes. He specifically mentions that, which is why I'm a little surprised that his very community would translate these instead of leaving them just like for the academics or in German. Because like you could make the argument, what do we need to know about those disputes today? It's really not relevant. Susanna says, people who don't want to marry with the Rabbanut can do so with chupot.org. It's not recognized by the state, but then you can zoom to Utah and have a civil ceremony, and the state will accept it as a legal wedding. Yes, and they used to all go to Cyprus as well. But the thing is, Jews in Israel and other places, Jews in Israel, look, you can get married any rabbi outside of Israel, and then you can bring it to Israel. It'll be accepted no matter who the rabbi is. It doesn't have to be Orthodox. But if you live in Israel, you want to have a wedding, and you want to have all your friends there, and you want to have the rabbi of your choice. You don't want to, you know, do it with some other thing. You want to have a rabbi. And so, yes, there are rabbis now, so or maybe dozen, I don't know, who will do it. But then you have to go. Like you said, you have to get married with a justice of the peace or a Zoom with someone or lifetime life minister, whatever they call it. Yeah. Oh, and Rabbi and David Eisen, our attorney, says that the jury is still out with respect to the validity of online weddings. Okay, we shall see. But you can definitely go to Cyprus if you want. The question is, should you have to go? And David says that. Okay, so we're waiting to see. And they're not recognized by the Rabbanut. That's
no,
another question. That's another
Supreme
question.
Court already decided.
It'll be recognized by the state. It won't be recognized by the Rabbanut. So that raises different issues. A lot of these people want it to be recognized by the Rabbanut. Well, thank you very much, David. And Marty says that the education system you think in Quebec is organized like the community in Germany. The government funds Catholic and Protestant school boards. There are no other public schools. The Jewish schools are funded by the government through the Protestant board. Yeah, that would be an interesting, that's very similar to that. The difference is, however, in Germany, it isn't just the school system. You can make a claim in case that we pay taxes, so fund the school system. It was the clergymen. It was the money for the, it was money for the community. Money would go back not just for schools, for everything in the community. The community would do with it what it sees fit. Now, it used to be that, you couldn't, if you declared yourself without a confession, that is, without a religion, you still had to pay the same taxes. Let's say you paid 9% to in Germany to the religion. It didn't mean that if you declared that you had no religion that you'd save the money. This would stay, this pay the same amount of taxes. It would just go to the government, and as opposed to the 9% going to the religion that you connect with. But I just emailed the other day Rabbi Jonah Zevers in Berlin. He's one of the rabbis in the Berlin community. He's not one of the Orthodox rabbis, but he's a very, very traditional non-Orthodox rabbi, about as right-wing conservative as you can get. And he probably has the largest private collection of Svarim in, well, I don't know, now you have that new Orthodox separatist community, but he has a very large collection of Svarim. Every time he hears of a new Sefer, he asks me where to get it. He told me that the situation today is that you pay 9%, so let's say $10,000 you'd pay, so let's say $1,000, what is that, $90? If you don't declare that you're part of a community, you don't pay it at all. So that, I think, would lead a lot of people not to declare. 9% is a lot. If you can save that money in your taxes, I think a lot of people would rather just be declared as having no religion than just think of irreligious Jews or someone from Israel who has no religion, or Americans, assimilated Jew. You go there, what do you need to belong to the community for? Which I'm surprised they changed that. Yes, Morty says Yishai Rebo had the crowd repeat Tehillim and then sang it afterwards. I couldn't make it there. Unfortunately, all my kids were there. Unfortunately, I couldn't make it. I had something at my university that I literally could not get out of. But I watched it and I was inspired. Look, half the talks, they get a little boring, because how many times can you have someone get up and say the same thing? But the idea of seeing people there, all there, in unity. And it was important. It's an important message. And someone says privately that Rav Hamburger in volume 3 or 4 of Shor Sheimen HaGashkenaz discusses the Upsharon and the pagan origins. And Rabbi Kelman says the non-Orthodox Orthodox are a dying breed. Hey, you get them in America. Just leave the big cities. You go to any shul outside the big cities in America, you have plenty of non-observant Orthodox. I read Daniel Gordas's piece, his declaring that he's leaving the conservative movement today. Of course, he comes from royalty in the conservative movement, Daniel Gordas. It seems to me it's a bit extreme, because most conservative rabbis don't share these radical left-wing views. It seemed to me he was going a little too far on that. Second of all, you raised the question. You have a lot of people now saying that Orthodox Jews should not send their kids to secular universities because of the situation there. So look, I think it's great to send them to YU. I have a son at YU. I think it's also great to start new universities, University of Austin, I think it's all right. But to give up the public square, at the end of the day, these people are, you know, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, they're going to be leaders of the world. To give up this completely, I think it would be a big mistake. By the same token, I would say, Gordas, why give it up? Well, if theologically it's a problem, that's one thing. But politically it's a problem, but you're going to give it up. Why not stay and fight? There's plenty of conservative rabbis who believe what he believes. Okay. Okay, everyone. Thank you all. It was great to see you tonight. Rabbi Kelman, any final words?
Yeah, you know, I agree. The rally was inspiring. And I mean, I watched it. And although the people who were there told me we probably heard it better than it was very hard to hear when you were there, of course, with 300,000 wow. people, but the feeling you get. But yeah, I sat glued pretty much, you know, it was really very, very.
And you know something, Rabbi Kelman? Everyone there, what was it? It was love. It was respect. All the policemen talked about how they were thanked so much. Look at the other rallies from the other side. It's violence. It's burning. It's attacks. It's profanity.
Correct. No, I, a lot of us, we were watching in the staff room together at chat, a few of us, and it was, yeah, it was, yeah, the contrast is unbelievable. But, you know, it's interesting. I totally understand why there was no rabbi, but I've had discussion. People here think, no, that's wrong. They should have had rabbis, and they should have had Orthodox and conservative and reform rabbis, which is what they did a little bit sort of in the round Trump that they didn't speak, but they did. They sort of
You couldn't because then you couldn't have the yeshiva.
No, words. I understand, but okay. That's a sad comment on our community. In other words, I was arguing, I totally get why I think the OU pushed for no rabbis. I totally get it. On the other hand, I also see it is a little sad. What, you can't hear reform rabbi speak? I know you're going to tell me, yes, you can't. That's how people think. But I think that's sad that's how people think. You know, like as you say, it's a political rally. We can work with the reform and conservative, but I get it. I understand it would have created a problem. But yes, I noticed no coalition, all that. They bent over backwards to appease the Orthodox. I mean, that's for sure.
Yeah. They came out. So many Orthodox came out, people from yeshiva circles, many of them came out. Baruch Hashem, I think.